You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn. Thanks for joining us for episode 10, Driven to Kill.
Tonight, we're on the case in Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, a quiet community about an hour and a half north of Philadelphia. It seemed like the perfect place for a newly married couple like Andrew and Joanne Katranak to settle down and start a family. But when Joanne and the couple's 15-week-old son, Alex, suddenly went missing, Catasauqua became the center of a terrifying mystery. December 15th, 1994, just days before Christmas. New parents Joanne and Andrew Katranak were getting ready for their first holiday with their brand new son, Alex. Andrew got home from work around 6:30, excited to see his little boy. But his wife's car was not out front. Commander Robert Wirtz.
Andrew gets home, and she's not home yet.
Andrew wasn't too concerned because he knew that his wife had made plans for the day.
Joanne had made arrangements with her mother-in-law to meet her to go shopping at the local mall. He knows that she had planned on doing some Christmas shopping with his mother, and so there's no flag that goes up that there's anything wrong at this point.
Andrew took care of some chores while he waited for them to get back. After 2 hours passed, he began to wonder what was going on.
He calls his mother and says, you know, have you seen Joanne? And she said, no, she was supposed to come. We were going to go shopping, but she never showed up.
Andrew's mother told him she waited over an hour for Joanne to pick her up that afternoon. She even called the house to see what had happened. But the phone just rang and rang, and the answering machine had never picked up. Andrew immediately called Joanne's sister, Peggy.
Andy said to me, he said, have you heard from your sister? And I said, no, I haven't talked to her. Why? And he's like, because, you know, she's not here. You know, there's chicken on the table, there's, you know, laundry laid out, and she's, I have no idea where she is.
The call from her brother-in-law worried Peggy. It just wasn't like Joanne to not keep her family informed of her whereabouts.
She would never just go without telling somebody where she's going. She wouldn't just disappear. And with the baby, it wouldn't have happened. It just wouldn't happen.
At that point, the entire family began to panic. While Peggy and Joanne's parents made the hour-long drive to Catasauqua, Andrew called the police to report his wife and son missing.
He calls the municipal police department, the Catasauqua Police Department, and reports them missing. Prior to their arrival, Andrew starts going through the house.
As he checked the house for any sign of where they went, he made a disturbing discovery. It appeared that someone had broken into the house.
He finds that the exterior door leading into the cellar, the lock has been pried off. It was a padlock, you put the screwdriver behind it and pull it off, and it didn't take a lot of work to get that done.
Andrew searched the basement and found another clue.
He goes into the basement to see if anything's been taken or there's anything out of place, and he finds that there's a telephone line that's been cut. The wires were pretty much just kind of hanging there.
The dangling cord explained why the answering machine never picked up his mother's call and seemed to confirm that something terrible had happened to his wife and son. But when the police arrived, they tried to calm Andrew down. They thought that his missing wife and the obvious signs of a break-in were just an unfortunate coincidence.
It did not raise any suspicions with the municipal police department. They thought it was possibly a separate incident that had nothing to do with her being missing.
The officers took a missing persons report, but didn't believe that foul play was involved in Joanne's disappearance. District Attorney Michael McIntyre.
Maybe she got tired of being married, took the baby, and decided to take off.
Sally O'Connor, Joanne's mother.
I thought Andy was going to punch one of them because they said, she probably ran away with the baby. And Andy is like, it's my wife you're talking about.
He was worried, concerned over it. He expressed the idea that Joanne wouldn't just walk away. He explained that everything was going fine in the marriage and there would be no reason for her to leave.
No one thought that Joanne had just taken off.
Never in a million years. She was just so happy. We kind of argued with the Catasauqua police because there's no way she would ever run away.
When Andrew showed Joanne's family the door that had been pried open, they began their own investigation.
We were really feeling scared because we just felt that somebody had taken them and, you know, we have to go find them. We were convinced that they were kidnapped.
The family frantically searched the neighborhood for Joanne and her baby.
We were just looking. We were walking streets. It was really, really cold.
Just after 3 a.m., Joanne's father called everyone to the empty parking lot of a local bar just a block away from the house.
He says, you better come down here and see what I found.
Backed into a space was a Toyota with an infant car seat.
I remember my dad saying, you know, is that Joanne's car? And I'm like, oh my God, it is.
For Joanne's family, finding her car backed into a spot in a parking lot just a block or so from the house was disheartening. Joanne had left no note and had made no calls. No one knew where she had gone. Her car just added to the mystery.
You know, the baby seat was there. And, you know, there was nothing else out of place. I mean, it was just parked.
It was clear the car had been there for many hours.
I felt the hood and, you know, it was cold. And then my brother-in-law called the local police at that point saying, we just found her car.
As they stood in the empty parking lot waiting for police to arrive, Joanne's family prayed that the young mother and her infant son would somehow be found as well. When police arrived, they didn't believe the parked car had any special significance.
They come to the scene, and the car is locked up, and basically they decide that, she parked the car here, but she's still just a missing person. There's nothing to it more than that.
They told him to get that car out of there and bring it back home. And Andy said, I'm not getting in that car. Because we felt that, you know, there could be evidence someone took her. And they just looked at us like we were crazy.
Fearing Joanne's car was part of a potential crime scene, Andy refused to move it from the parking lot.
Andy said, you're not to touch that car.
Peggy, Joanne's sister, sided with Andy and even went a step further.
My daughter spoke to a relative and he suggested that she call the FBI.
It wasn't just finding Joanne's empty car that frightened her family. It was also the way it had been parked. When they saw it had been backed into the spot at the bar parking lot, they were certain that meant someone else had left it there.
My sister didn't know how to back up the car. You know, she wasn't a city girl at all.
Joanne in a million years would not have backed in. If she couldn't go straight in, she didn't park.
Andrew was also convinced that there was no way his wife had parked the car.
It appears that Joanne was absolutely terrible at backing a car up, and this was parked in a parking spot between two vehicles. His initial reaction was she didn't park that car there. There's no way that she backed into that parking spot.
And when they looked through the window of the car, there were more clues. Even though the doors were locked, they could see Joanne's keys were inside, lying on the floor. There was also something troubling about the way the driver's seat was positioned. District Attorney Michael McIntyre.
Andy, when he looks into the car, he notices the seat is in a different place, position from where Joanne would have it. Joanne was very small, and Andy noted that the seat was like for a larger person.
Joanne's family believed everything they had found pointed to the same terrifying conclusion. Joanne and her 15-week-old son, Alex, had been kidnapped. And whoever had taken them had parked her car in the lot to throw them off the trail. The Pennsylvania State Police were called in, and Commander Robert Wirtz sent his more experienced troopers to the scene.
I was able to send the forensic unit up, and we were able to get into the car and process for evidence.
They came and they put the car on a flatbed and took it to the trooper headquarters, which is where they processed it.
We're looking for hairs and fibers and any other evidentiary matter that we can come up with.
One of the crime scene analysts noticed something odd on the headrest of the driver's seat.
One of our state troopers went in and actually saw it with his naked eye, saw six, about 8-inch, dirty blonde-type hairs. Took them all, put them in a plastic bag.
The dirty blonde hairs simply didn't make sense, since Joanne Katranak's hair was dark brown. The evidence they collected was submitted to the state police crime lab for testing. Investigators then moved to the Katranak home.
We took samples of the pry marks. We looked at and photographed the wire that had been cut.
But at the Katranak home, investigators found no signs of a struggle or a robbery. The only things amiss were the lock on the cellar door and the cut phone line. In fact, nothing else in the house appeared to have been disturbed.
We had Andy go through the house. We went through the house with him. There seemed to be absolutely nothing, with the exception of a couple things that would be with the baby and with Joanne that was gone from the house.
Joanne and baby Alex were missing. There was no indication that Joanne had taken off on her own. By all indications, the mother and baby had been kidnapped, and where they were and who had them was a mystery.
It made us think that we had something much more than a missing person investigation at that point.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. It's my favorite time of the year, the holiday season. I love everything about it, especially the giving spirit. I put a lot of effort into finding the perfect gift for everyone on my list. I want to give my friends and family something they can really use, something beautiful that will last. That's why I shop at Quince. Everything is high quality at a price that actually makes sense. Quince has so many choices. Soft Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50 that actually look and feel like designer pieces. Beautiful hats, scarves, and coats that keep you warm. And they all hold up, no matter how often you wear them. Find gifts so good, you'll want to keep them
at Quince. And if their prices weren't low enough already, here's a way to save even more. Go to quince.com/OTCpod for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/OTCpod to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/OTCpod.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
As the hours passed with no sign of Joanne and baby Alex, investigators knew they had to spring into action. Commander Robert Wirtz.
You've got a situation here where you have a woman and her infant that have just sort of disappeared. We've already spoken to both sides of the family. Both the mother and father welcome this child. There was really no reason that we could come up with initially in the investigation to indicate why she would just walk away.
With the very real possibility that Joanne and baby Alex had been abducted, the state police started interviewing Joanne's family and were quickly pointed in the direction of a possible suspect.
Sally O'Connor, Joanne's mother.
When the police officers asked who I thought, you know, would harm Joanne, I immediately said to look at her first husband.
Before Joanne met Andrew Katernack, she had been married for 5 months.
Peggy Corder, Joanne's sister.
It was not a good marriage. He was not very nice to her. He was verbally abusive, and I didn't want her in that situation, so she ended up coming actually to live with me.
Joanne's family told police that her ex-husband had a hard time accepting the end of their relationship. Even after their divorce was finalized, he continued to pursue Joanne, something that became a growing concern to her family.
He did go to Peggy's where Joanne was staying, and he kind of stalked her. And I remember saying, if he does that again, we will call the police.
Police tracked down Joanne's ex-husband and brought him in for an interview.
We looked at him very closely. He was interviewed. We looked at his work record. We determined where he was on the date of the disappearance.
Under intense questioning, Joanne's ex told police everything he had done the day Joanne went missing.
I would say it took probably the better part of a week to follow up on his statement, to go and check alibis, to check work records.
Ultimately, his alibi was rock solid. Police were confident that he couldn't have been at the Katernack home that day.
Within a week or so, we had cleared him of any suspicion.
After Joanne's ex-husband was officially ruled out as a suspect, investigators began to consider the person closest to Joanne and Alex, Andrew Katernack.
District Attorney Michael McIntyre.
80% of the time, it is the husband. If it is someone close to the person.
Could the man who reported his wife and child missing
also be the one responsible for the crime.
We're looking at Andrew, and we're looking at him hard.
Trooper Joe Vasquez was assigned the task of determining if Andrew Katranak had played a role in his wife's disappearance.
We knew that we had to either put Andy in or get him out.
And you have to start with the people that are closest to the quote-unquote victim, or victims in this case. Over 80% of the victims in a homicide investigation know their assailant. So you want to start with the people that are closest to the victim.
Andrew was cooperative and seemed willing to help the investigation.
What he said to us was that, listen, I need you to get past me. Do what you have to do. I don't care what it is. You can ask. I will do anything. All I want you to do is get my wife and my baby back.
Behind the scenes, Andrew answered the most difficult questions a husband and father could be asked. Yet, just hours later, he found the strength to share his pain on television.
I've seen this happen on TV before, you know, and you read about it, but you can never really fully appreciate what the person's going through until it happens to you. And I wouldn't wish this on anybody.
Police dug into Andrew and Joanne's relationship, searching for a motive.
It appeared that everything was going very well in the marriage.
While their marriage seemed solid, their finances were a different story.
There was some indication that they were struggling, but he was employed, he was working, he was bringing money into the house. So while it was probably difficult for them, it wasn't impossible.
Investigators interviewed everyone who knew the couple, even one of Andrew's ex-girlfriends. The woman gave police what appeared to be an important piece of information.
She had heard that Andrew really couldn't have a child, and so young Alex must have been somebody else's baby, and that must have meant that Andy was upset with his wife, and that's probably a motive for Andy to have hurt his wife.
Investigators took the woman's claim very seriously and even asked Andrew to take a paternity test. The results were clear.
This, in fact, was his child.
Still, detectives were suspicious and asked Andrew to describe in detail what he had done the day Joanne and his son went missing. Andrew answered a lot of tough questions, but the information they were most interested in were his whereabouts on the day Joanne and his baby went missing.
He worked all day.
Andrew said he was helping his father renovate a home. Police talked with the owners of the home Andrew had been working on.
We actually sent people to the house, and we talked to the adults that were there, and even the kids said that he had been there during the time that his wife had disappeared.
Once his alibi was confirmed, Andrew Katranak was officially cleared as a suspect in his wife's disappearance. Joanne's family never doubted that Andrew was telling the truth.
Peggy Corder, Joanne's sister.
It was really infuriating because, you know, we knew from the beginning that he had nothing to do with it. You know, we all felt like they were wasting time on him when they should be out looking for them. But he said, I'll do anything that they want me to do, you know, as long as they help me find them.
Sally O'Connor, Joanne's mother.
Was angry. I was very angry because I knew Andy did not have anything to do with her disappearance.
So how was Joanne's mother so sure of her son-in-law's innocence?
I knew how much he loved her and the baby, and there was no way that Andy would ever harm her.
The search for a suspect was back to square one. Investigators reviewed the evidence found inside the Katranak home. There was something about the scene that didn't sit well with them. Everything was just a little too neat. On the surface, it appeared that an intruder had broken into the home. But a closer examination gave rise to the theory that the crime was an inside job.
cut the phone wire, it would appear that someone at least had some knowledge of that house.
Detectives wondered how the kidnapper could have gotten Joanne and the baby out of the house without neighbors seeing them leave.
The neighbors weren't able to add anything to the investigation.
Since the neighbors had no leads for the investigators, the police decided to use the media to reach out to the community for help.
Anyone that may have seen any type of suspicious activity or suspicious vehicles in the area of the Katranac residence, we would like them to give us a telephone call.
The barrage of media coverage surrounding the case generated thousands of tips for detectives to follow.
We had a report that a woman on a flight out of the Lehigh Valley International Airport was seated on a flight, and in the seat next to her, she said it was Joanne and the infant.
FAA and airline records prove the woman was not Joanne Katranac.
It was a dead-end lead. It just never went anyplace.
But investigators refused to give up hope.
I think the group of troopers that were assigned to this investigation consistently held out hope that maybe she had walked away, that we would, in fact, find her and the baby alive. I think that was the hope that everybody held on to. I know I did.
But as the days rolled on with no sign of Joanne, investigators officially ruled out the possibility that she had simply run away. Trooper Joseph Vasquez.
Nothing on credit history, nothing on anything that she owned, nothing. So we were reasonably sure that she had not walked away on her own.
Not knowing what had happened to Joanne and her infant son was torture for her family.
Each night I would lie in bed and I would talk to Joanne and say, if there's anything you could do to let us know where you are, show us a sign. I never gave up hope that they would find them alive.
4 months after Joanne and baby Alex had vanished, a call came in to the Pennsylvania State Police. A farmer had found what appeared to be a woman's body in the woods near his property.
It's a wooded area. There is somewhat of a trail that runs through the woods. It's just off of the trail in a very small clearing, maybe 10, 12 feet in from the edge of this field. You could see it from the field, but you would have to be looking in that direction. Off to the side, there is what appears to be a pile of garbage, old clothing. He stops the tractor, goes over to see what it is. As he gets closer, he realizes that this is not a mannequin. This is a human being.
The mystery deepens after this.
Danger lurks in the American landscape.
No one in their right mind would be out here, which makes it the perfect place to kill someone.
Introducing Hot and Deadly from ID, your podcast for classic American true crime served with a side of biscuits and gravy. On each episode, you'll hear some of ID's most shocking stories of murder and betrayal, from the mystery of a preacher shot and killed by a bow and arrow to a former prom queen gone missing and found murdered. Listen to Hot and Deadly on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
When the call went out over the police radios that someone had found a body in the woods, investigators working the Katrinak case collectively held their breath. Commander Robert Wirtz.
The first officer to arrive was a trooper who was on patrol in uniform at a marked car. He goes up, he verifies, in fact, that we have a human being.
That trooper was Joe Vasquez.
She was laying on her back, and her knees were slightly bent towards the open field. The baby was over the top of her midsection, face down, stone sleeper. She was wearing the leather jacket that I had a picture of, and the baby was wearing the blue sleeper that we had a picture of. So there was no doubt in my mind of who I was looking at.
Trooper Vasquez knew right away what everyone feared. These were the bodies of Joanne and Alex Katrinak. An autopsy confirmed that Vasquez was right.
The investigation, obviously, at that point, takes a complete different turn. We're no longer looking at a missing persons. We're now looking at a homicide investigation, two homicides, in fact.
Robert Wirtz and his team of seasoned investigators had hoped to find Joanne and Alex alive. Due to the horrific nature of the crime, this one hit a little closer to home for many officers.
Really, to say the least, it was such a letdown for us that she was dead. It affected people. We cared for what happened to this woman and her infant.
The coroner wasn't sure whether baby Alex had died from exposure or had been suffocated. But there was little mystery as to how Joanne died.
She'd been shot once in the face and then beaten about the head and face with an unknown weapon.
Ballistics testing revealed that the gun used to kill Joanne was a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol. One of the troopers on the scene offered a theory on how she had sustained her other injuries.
He had done an investigation years ago, not related to this at all, where an individual had shot somebody with a semi-automatic pistol and the gun jammed. And they then used the gun to beat them about the head and face.
Had the same thing happened during Joanne's murder? Officers scoured the area for any other clues.
I had approximately 30 troopers that raked piece by piece through an area across that entire scene, looking for any type of evidence whatsoever. We picked up a baby's rattler, the bag that Joanne had carried all of the items for the infant, a baby's bottle in the area, and we did find more hair.
Investigators recovered two dirty blonde hairs on a diaper bag found at the scene. They appeared to match the ones found on the headrest of Joanne's car. They were sent to the state crime lab for analysis.
It could not be excluded, and that's how this is written. It could not be excluded that both samples came from the same source.
District Attorney Michael McIntyre.
Whoever left that hair had driven that car. And it had to be the killer.
But who could have committed this unthinkable crime? As investigators analyzed the crime scene, they gave a lot of thought to its location. The bodies had been found in an extremely remote spot, 15 miles from the Katrinak home. They believed the killer had carefully chosen the area. Trooper Joseph Vasquez.
It was a place of safety for the person that did the killing because they would have had to have been comfortable here knowing they wouldn't get caught here. If you don't know where this place is at, you're not finding it.
Investigators now had the grim task of breaking the news to Joanne's family that she and baby Alex were never coming home.
Sally O'Connor, Joanne's mother.
I knew when the knock came to the door, I opened the door and I got hysterical. And I said, "You found them." And, you know, he shook his head.
Peggy Corder, Joanne's sister.
I got a call from my parents that they found them. So I immediately, you know, drove to Hackettstown, which is where my parents lived. The police had come to their door to tell them that they believed that we found them. There was a farmer that went out to plow his land in the spring and had come across the bodies, and the police knew it was them because the jacket she was wearing and what the baby was wearing.
Joanne's family had tried to stay positive throughout the period she had been missing. When they got the tragic news, it took a long time before they could accept their loss.
I think it really sunk in the day of the funeral. That's when I fell apart. It was like she was supposed to come home.
The funeral was massive. More than 300 people showed up to support the family. Joanne and baby Alex were buried in the same coffin.
My dad, he took it hardest. He just became like a different person, very withdrawn and, you know, just wasn't barely functioning.
Even the seasoned detectives that worked the case were devastated by the tragedy. They were more determined than ever to bring Joanne and baby Alex's killer to justice. Andrew Katternack unknowingly was about to provide the next big break in the case.
At some point after we find the bodies, the troopers take Andrew on a ride, not to the scene, but generally in the area of the scene. Was there any reason that Joanne would be in that area? Did Joanne know somebody in that area? Was there any reason that she would have gone there with the baby? And the answer basically is no. There would have been nothing for her, no reason for her to go to that area.
But then he remembered something that would change the course of the investigation. He said that one of his ex-girlfriends, a woman named Patricia Rohrer, had boarded her horses in the area.
The investigators ask him, well, what was the name of the stable? He said, I can't remember the name of the stable. He said, but I can tell you how to get there. Well, tell me how to get there. Well, he starts describing how to get, you know, to this stable. And the investigators at this point know that he's taking them to the scene of the crime.
This wasn't the first time investigators had talked with Patricia Rohrer. She was the woman who had told them that Andrew wasn't able to father a child. Andrew told police all about his ex-girlfriend. He said they had dated for 3 years and had lived together in the same house where Andrew and Joanne had started their family. When the relationship ended, Patricia moved to North Carolina. But Andrew said Patricia never got over the breakup and still called from time to time, even after he had married Joanne. In fact, just 3 days before Joanne and Alex disappeared, Patricia had made one of those calls, but it was Joanne who answered.
She answers the phone, and it's Pat Rohrer who wants to talk to Andrew. And she tells her that, you know, we're married, we have a baby, you're not to call here again. And she's rather forceful in telling her that.
Andrew told police he didn't think much of that call at the time, although it clearly had bothered his wife. Now detectives wondered if that call had somehow been a trigger that had set Rohrer off. With each detail Andrew gave to detectives, another piece of the puzzle seemed to come together. Patricia Rohrer used to live in the Katternack home and knew the basement door was an easy way into the house. She was very familiar with the area where the bodies were found, and she had had a fight with Joanne just days before she and her infant son disappeared.
At this point, we're now looking at her as the possible perpetrator.
The next step was to track down Patricia Rohrer, who was living in North Carolina. Investigators were confident that when they spoke with her face-to-face and searched her property, they would find the evidence they needed to arrest her. But the case against Rohrer started to fall apart as soon as they found her at her home. District Attorney Michael McIntyre.
The warrant is we're looking for a person with dirty blonde hair. Patricia Rohrer says to one of the police officers, "Dirty blonde hair? Why are you looking at me? Can't you see my hair is dark brown?"
Rohrer also provided police with an alibi for the day Joanne and baby Alex disappeared. She said she had been at a spa that day and went to a cowboy nightclub in the evening. Both were in North Carolina, more than 500 miles away from the Katranach home. Investigators were frustrated. If she was telling the truth, it meant the investigation was back to square one. But instead of just scratching her off the list of suspects, detectives decided to check out her story.
The investigators spoke with the owner of the spa, and the owner of the spa says she couldn't have been here on that day. We were closed. And she verified that by going through her schedules and showing us that the place was closed. She could not have been there.
Next, investigators went to the nightclub Rohrer said she had visited.
We interviewed the owner of the bar, and he said, well, they have to sign in, so let me check the sign-in book.
The nightclub had a strict policy. To get into the club, you had to sign in.
We got all the sign-in sheets, and we could prove she was there like 3 days before, 3 days after, but for the 3 days around this thing, she wasn't on the sign-in sheet.
The owner told detectives that no one ever got into the club without signing the book.
They're required to sign in when they come into the establishment. There was no signature for her.
Investigators continued to uncover lies Rohrer had told them. During her interview, she said she had never owned a gun. But when they spoke with one of her boyfriends, he contradicted that story.
During the course of that interview, he tells him that Pat Rohrer did have a gun.
Annie went a step further by describing exactly what type of gun it was that she owned.
The gun was a .22 caliber semi-automatic weapon.
Rohrer's ex-boyfriend also told investigators that her firearm didn't work properly.
One of the issues with this gun was that when you fired it once, it jammed, and you had to clear the action before you could fire it a second time. But every time you fired it, it jammed.
In the early days of the investigation, police had speculated that whoever murdered Joanne had used a gun that jammed. The case against Patricia Rohrer seemed to be coming together, but police still had one major piece of evidence that didn't add up. The hairs they had found in Joanne's car and on the baby's bag were dirty blonde. Investigators kept digging. They checked into everything Rohrer had done in the weeks leading up to the murders.
We discovered that she had entered in a rodeo and won trophy or a ribbon.
The rodeo was in Oklahoma just 10 days before Joanne and baby Alex were abducted. Investigators asked the organizers to see the champion's photograph. When they received the photograph, there was something that caught their attention, the color of Patricia Rohrer's hair, the same color of the hairs found in Joanne's car and at the crime scene.
Dirty blonde.
Police obtained a sample of Rohrer's hair for testing.
We get the report back. It cannot be ruled out that the samples from the car, the samples from the diaper bag, and the samples from Patricia Rohrer came from the same individual. As far as I was concerned, we solved the case.
Patricia Rohr was arrested and extradited to Pennsylvania.
Rohr was charged by the Pennsylvania State Police with two open counts of criminal homicide in connection with the deaths of Joanne and Alex Katranak.
For Joanne's family, Patricia Rohr's arrest was just the first step in their quest for justice. Peggy Corder, Joanne's sister.
It was, you know, relief, but anxiety, because it's like, okay, well, now let's get her convicted.
The state of Pennsylvania versus Patricia Rohr began on February 6th, 1998.
My mom and I were there every day. It's almost feeling of nausea. You know, it was just, you know, it just kind of makes you sick to your stomach. It's like, how could you? How could you do that?
Prosecutors told the jury that Rohr became enraged after Joanne hung up on her and was furious that she had been told that she could never speak with Andrew again. They said that after that call, Rohr drove to Pennsylvania and broke into the house that she had once lived in by prying open the basement door. District Attorney Michael McIntyre.
I think she got in through the basement. I think she cut the telephone lines. I think she waited. I think Patricia approached with a gun and just said, do what I say.
Rohr forced the young mother and her son into Joanne's car and murdered them in a deserted wooded area.
I don't think Joanne could have done anything to save herself or her baby.
Detectives had a theory what Rohr had done after killing Joanne.
Got back into Joanne's car, drove back to Catasauqua, parked Joanne's car in the parking lot of the local bar, and got in her car and drove back to North Carolina.
Patricia Rohr's attorneys claim she had no reason to hurt Joanne or her 15-week-old son.
And that's the best thing the defense had. Your motive is nuts. No one kills somebody over a hang-up phone call. Nobody does.
Rohr even took the stand in her own defense.
I had one question for her after another that just kept getting her all tangled up. She just couldn't tell the truth. I mean, she couldn't. When you're guilty, you can't tell the truth.
I mean, she was not believable at all.
And Rohr had no explanation for the prosecution's most damning piece of evidence.
How could her hair be at the scene and be in that car? It has to be her.
After just 2 hours of deliberation, the jury came back with its verdict. Joanne's family sat anxiously in court, hoping that they would finally get justice for the murder of their loved ones.
Not knowing if whether or not we were going to get the guilty verdict we wanted. That was the hardest part. And I remember the day that the jury came in, it was only a matter of hours that they deliberated.
Patricia Rohr, guilty of kidnapping and two counts of murder.
Just remember when we heard guilty and I just filled up and I was like, oh, thank God. We got her. We just got her.
Joanne's sister believes that Rohr murdered Joanne and baby Alex because she was obsessed with Andrew and couldn't accept that he was happy with another woman.
I think she saw that Andy was happy with another woman and had a beautiful baby. I think maybe she still held out hope that at one point they would maybe get back together. And once she realized that that was never going to happen, I think her jealousy just took over and she got enraged.
Before sentencing, Joanne's family got a chance to read their victim's impact statement directly to Rohr.
Sally O'Connor, Joanne's mother.
I wanted her to hear what she did to our lives. She took my beautiful daughter. She took my beautiful grandson for a phone call. It just never made any sense. I just hope she rots. It's not a nice thing to say, but that's how I feel.
The judge gave Rohr two life sentences for the murders and two 20 to 40 year sentences for the kidnappings. But to this day, Patricia Rohr has never taken any responsibility for her crime.
it makes me angry. You know, I mean, you're just not dealing with a sane person. She's a psychopath.
The loss of Joanne will haunt them forever.
She cheated us out of all the years that I would have had, you know, my sister helping me raise my daughter. She cheated my daughter out of her aunt who adored her. The feeling of loss just never goes away.
Joanne's family believes that Patricia Rohr's crimes also claimed a third victim. Shortly after Joanne and Alex were found murdered, her father passed away. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.